Welcome, dive buddies. This is Scuba Coach
Under the Sea,
the podcast for the inquisitive diver.
Hey there, dive buddies, and welcome to the 50th episode of the Scuba Goat Podcast. This marks over 2 years of the show and its superb content from a vast array of ocean lovers. Today, I am joined by a man who, through his own successes, has managed to retire long before his own 50th and redirect that determination to succeed on coral conservation. A successful businessman, surfer, diver, and artist now turned conservationist, Jolyon Collier founded the not-for-profit organisation Counting Coral a little over 2 years ago. Utilising his skills from the construction industry, Jolyon set about designing a sculptural coral bank with several goals in mind. The main goal, of course, a platform for coral propagation with the additional intentions of attracting stakeholders in the projects from corporations, resorts, tourists and locals alike. By creating an environment that appeals to the masses, Jolyon and his team also teach the stakeholders about their reefs and raise awareness of the importance of the coral in our world and indeed the Earth's life cycle. Jolyon, welcome to the show, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it. I really love your show.
Oh, good on you, good on you. I did have a sneaky peek into the background, you know, when we got put in touch with, what's her name, Catherine. And had a sneaky peek to see what you're doing, and I see that you've had a few chats yourself, and one of my good buddies there, Christina Zanato.
Oh yeah, we love Christina. She's awesome, big advocate for the sharks and the ocean, and we're hoping to actually work with her in the future. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah, have you got an opportunity to get over there and dive with her at some point?
No, not yet. We've been so focused on Fiji for the last couple of years that we're just keeping all our attention on that, on those reefs, and being in that region of the world for right now. But we are expanding pretty soon, within the next year and a half. So we hope to kind of just, you know, reach out and start those dialogues, because what we do is an incredibly complex and long process. That we go down these roads and then all of a sudden we hit a brick wall and we can't get past that brick wall and we've just wasted months. So we're very, very cautious about the directions that we go with our organization, because it's very, very complicated.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tell you what, before we get into the complexities of Counting Coral, let's back it right the way back up and just find out, where did your link with the ocean first evolve?
Well, so I grew up in England, so it's an island, we're fully surrounded by water, but I was very fortunate as a young kid. I grew up in Torquay, so we were kind of close to what they consider the English Riviera, even though that's a very large stretch to even call it a Riviera. But you know, the ocean was there. We used to go cliff jumping as youngsters, you know. We didn't have the rules that the youngsters have these days. We'd jump off a 100-foot cliff and miss the rocks barely and, you know, survive and laugh about it and have fun. And started snorkeling at a very young age, actually, on Tor Abbey Sands. And that's where it all kicked it off for me. And then I was lucky to fast forward, like, to be able to come to Malibu, California when I was a young kid, because my dad moved out here and I used to visit him on summer holidays. Got into surfing. Got into boogie boarding, then got into diving, then went to Fiji on a trip when I was in my early 20s. And as soon as I saw those coral reefs, those oceans, those waves, I was like madly hooked for videography work. So I bought a camera, bought a housing, went to Fiji every year for 13 years filming the surfers. I was one of the first people to actually start. I was one of the first people to actually start filming and selling DVDs back in the day. Most people were doing images, and I was working from the mainland resorts, not these, you know, Tavarua and Namutus, which cost you an absolute arm and a leg, and they're super restrictive back in those days when you could surf on, like, you know, cloud breaks and Namutus left and breaks like that. So I would surf all the I would film all the other stuff that you just your average surfer could get in the lineup on. And, you know, I'd smash it every year, selling them the DVDs, have enough money to travel the islands and I found myself filming a lot of reefs while I was waiting for the surfers to drop in on a 15-foot wave, just absolutely bricking it because they're not used to that size of wave, you know. So it's kind of cool in that respect. So that's how I kind of fell in with the love of oceans and coral reefs, from being a kid to then traveling the world and then finding Fiji.
Awesome. And obviously that was in your 20s, but back in you permanently moved to California by this time?
Yeah, I'd actually made the leap at 19 to move out here.
Okay.
And that's where my diving career kind of kicked off, because we're right here next to the beach, and a good buddy of mine, actually, I was doing a job for him, and you know, because I'm in the construction industry, so he was kind of like a really cool landscaper guy. He used to be a commercial abalone diver and sea urchin diver off the coast here when it was fruitful times for abalone. And I saw an old dive kit in his garage when we were working. I was like, what's that, man? He's like, oh, it's a tank. And I'm like, when we're talking tank, I'm talking a tank with a plastic board with canvas straps. I'm not joking. This is something from Jacques Cousteau days. And he's like, hey.
That's what I was just about to say.
Oh, no, it's 100% like 1970s, something like that.
Yeah.
And because those boys back in those days didn't care, they're abalone guys, right? They'd chuck on their gear, drop down, just go nuts, get in abalone and come back up. So he goes, you want to have a go at it? I was like, yeah. So he chucked me in the pool and I was breathing and bubbling away. And I think I was like 20, maybe 20 at that time, maybe 21. And I jumped in the pool. I said, dude, this is awesome. How do I get in the ocean? He's like, well, let's go to the beach next week. I was like, all right, sweet. So we went down to the beach. And for anyone who's listening who's a diver, this is a big no-no, or want to be a diver. If you're a diver, you already know this. But he basically gave me a weight belt and this canvas strap, regulator, and pressure gauge, and sent me off on my own. Goes, just go out there and, you know, go down. Whatever you do, don't hold your breath on the way up. So I believed him that this was normal. I just swam out, dropped down, went through the kelp beds, obviously super dangerous, went through all the kelp beds, had a good time, came up, came back, and that was it. I was totally hooked on diving, and it's been a relentless pursuit of diving ever since, and videography work and surfing and everything else to do with the ocean. Yeah. But yeah.
And then 35 years later, you did your open water.
Yeah. Pretty much. I think because I'm old, no one asks for my card anymore. I could have been uncertified this whole time, I think.
Oh, dear. And did you, was it that point there where you started to, move into getting your own gear and maybe getting certified and taking a camera down with you to get better angles or something for the surfers, or was it more for the reefs?
It was pretty much immediate. As soon as I come out with that tank on my back, like dragging myself up on the shore, because obviously I'm exhausted, never done that before, I immediately went to a place called Sports Chalet, which is a sports center, took the course straight away with my buddy, and then we just started getting a good community of friends joining the crew. And then back in those days, like Sports Chalet had instructors, but the instructors would do these dive trips, and the sports chalet didn't care if they did these trips with all the students. It was like, hey, if you're certified and you want to go on a trip, that's their business. So we would go, you know, Mexico, Hawaii, all these places, and just travel with these guys. And we're talking mental cases, slightly unhinged, not right in the head, doing like, you know, drinking till 4 o'clock in the morning every night, and then diving all day long. I mean, relentlessly crazy party people. I wasn't quite in that wheelhouse for me, so I'd kind of like creep off to bed at like 10 at night, because I'm like, I don't want to dive while I've been drinking. It doesn't feel good. I'm already sick on a boat anyway. But it was just like this passion for diving. You know what it's like. Once you're hooked on diving, you can't really stop, in my opinion anyway. So it was just a relentless pursuit of just enjoying life, you know what I mean? And having that adventure of the unknown. I mean, back in those days, I mean, there were still places you could explore in those days. And I'm not that old. I'm only 50, right? But back 30 years ago, you could still travel the world and go to places where there's no one been. You could still dive spots that were pretty hard to get to. You know, I've been to Tonga and remote islands diving with, you know, humpback whales. I mean, you don't get to do that stuff these days with regulations and stuff. So it was really a cool time to explore the oceans. And you know, once I went to Fiji on my round the world tour and I was surfing, I realized there was a big market for videographer work, because like I say, anyone who was doing shooting back in those days were only shooting the big boy resorts, which cost $5,000-$6,000 a week, and you had to have 21 people book. You had to book out the whole island with your crew. You couldn't just tag along. So they were exclusive, but for your average surfer, no one was doing anything. So as soon as I jumped into the water, started filming, we'd go back to the resort at the bar, and I'd edit at the bar. And then I'd put it up on the big screen, and all the lads are like, oh my God, you know, can I book you for tomorrow? And I'd start booking 3-4 guys at $150 a DVD, and, you know, doing $500 a day of just chilling out in Fiji, surfing and filming for a few hours. So that was my vacation money. So I was super stoked with that, you know, and that's where the reef kicked in really heavily for me, because I would spend so much time with the camera in the water filming reefs, and then it was like, I'm there to film surfers, but I'm filming the reef, and then all of a sudden they're dropping in on the wave, and I'd lift the camera up and go, thank God I got that shot, because he just paid me $150. You know, but I'd be filming the sharks and the turtles and all that going through the lineup of the surf, because when the surf would peel up, like a 15-foot wave, when it peels up, you can see the sharks swimming in the backside of it, and you had a really different perspective of coral reefs and the life when those waves pick up. So I just thought it was like a cool lens that you could look through the wave and see the wildlife, you know, seeing big schools of fish cruising past like a TV screen because there's a wall of water in front of you. It's super interesting and fun for me.
That sounds amazing. And your surfer that's paying you $150, you can, you know, there's your... there's your toe in the top left corner of those 4-second frames of 5 minutes of video.
That's what it was like. Yeah, you got to understand, like, these boys were coming from home reefs, right? So they're like doing beach breaks or point breaks. You come out to Fiji, you're in the middle of the ocean. There's no marker points. It's just a flat, like, submerged reef, and that water pulls up over the reef. So you can't have, like, normally as a surfer, you're in the lineup, you've got a house over there and a house over there. You can triangulate your position. You know where the waves are coming. But out on the reef, you've got no idea what's going on. The water's pulling you everywhere. So it would take those boys about 2 hours before they even drop in on the first wave. So I've already surfed a couple hours, realizing they got to get their nerves out. So I'm pretty happy that I've got my surf in. Then I go grab my camera as they start to get comfortable with the lineup and figuring out the swells and stuff. And then I'd film for maybe 2 hours and then surf an hour and go home. Do like 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, it's just as well. It's warm water, right?
Oh, it's too hot. You'd be baking. Camera would warm up.
Yeah. What was the first camera that you were using then?
It was a P200 Sony analog tape camera and an Ocean Image housing. So it was like a aluminum brick with a tiny little tape camera in the middle of it, because that was the only housing camera at that time that was just super easy. But you know, I got some good shots. It wasn't like super pro, and it didn't have to be, because I wasn't like filming pro guys for like Roxy or, you know, Quicksilver or anything. It was just a bunch of tourists trying to grab a good DVD of themselves, because no one's ever taken the time to film them, you know.
Yeah. And what year was this again, roughly?
This was 2001 onwards. Okay. So it was when Mac came out with iMovie. So it's not like I could, and I only had 100 gig hard drives at that time. So imagine I'm trying to edit all this material on 100 gig hard drive plus whatever computer space I had with a tape analog camera using iMovie, because that's all I could get to go down there with as a portable unit that worked out really super like easy for me. So I've literally, looking at this computer now, the only disc that I have of that content is trapped in this computer, because my computer DVD player crapped out on me and the DVD stuck in it, because I'd have to keep chucking the material away. I'd have to delete it all because I couldn't keep enough space on a 100 gig hard drive to keep that editing going for months on end, you know.
Yeah.
So I lost a lot of footage, unfortunately. Wow. Yeah.
For me, I was starting to get a little bit bored with teaching, and it was becoming mundane, which was moving away from the whole reason why I was doing the job. And then, you know, at some point, I didn't have many customers and I took a camera. And it was like scuba diving had just completely rejuvenated within my life. It was completely different type of diving. And dare I say it, I'm probably further down the road now of being possibly one of those annoying old fellas with a big fucking camera in his hand that just has too much light and too much time on his hands. But yeah, it's for me, having a camera in your hand and diving, the two just, they're just intrinsically linked, and I can't. I enjoy diving, but if I've not got a camera in my hand to capture a moment or a photo or a bit of video, then it's nowhere near as fun. And that's just for me. And I think that's the evolution of my progression through diving. So when you're saying that you've got all this stuff that's just a memory now, and you know, lost in the ether of the tapes, I kind of think of how many hard drives I've got sitting in the cupboard here behind me. There must be 5 or 6 terabytes of shite that I'll probably never look at, but it's still there.
Yeah, I don't think I could dive without a camera. No. Something missing when I'm in the water and I don't have something. It's weird. I agree with you on
that
one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had I also had a good buddy of mine in Sydney. He's got a store, Macro Mode, and he specifically does underwater photography, and he's really, really good. And he heard I was going down to the GP, up to the GBR, and said, "Oh, you need to try this, because we were going to get the coral spawning, hopefully on video." So it's like, take this, take this, take this, take this. And it's just as well I've got a really strong back, because carrying a rucksack and pulling a wheelie bag and trying to pretend that there's only 7 kilos in each one is a bit of a feat.
Yeah, it can be quite complicated with all the gear. We just did an installation in Fiji. We had 2 A7S Sony S3 Sony cameras, 2 housings, 5 GoPros, 3 drones, not to mention all the dive gear. We had underwater drills, grinders, and those batteries are huge. They weigh an absolute ton. Some of the gear is just ridiculous, and we're pulling it all through customs, hoping we're not going to get a hit bringing in tools and stuff like that. You know, it's comical. Diving's comical. You just drag so much stuff around with you, and you can't help it.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's introduce the listeners to actually why you're on the show and what you're doing. So let's talk about counting coral.
Yeah, so I am the president of Counting Coral, which is a registered 501c3 non-profit, and we design, build, install, and donate sculptural underwater marine parks specifically designed to house coral. So in a simple way of putting at it, it's like a coral nursery, but very artistically designed. And we plant the coral on that nursery as you would any nursery that you're trying to grow out coral on. We just happen to make it look a little bit nicer. And when we do that, we tick quite a considerable amount of boxes that other organizations aren't really ticking in terms of what needs to happen nowadays with retention spans of people and social media and stuff like that. So we definitely took a very unusual approach to what we do in that respect.
Hmm. And I mean, that kind of covers my initial thoughts when Catherine got in touch and I started to have a look at what you were doing was, what's the difference between counting coral and, you know, a dive shop in Thailand somewhere putting some metal frames underwater and attaching some coral structures to assist in the growth. So having that design element behind it, I assume that is bringing a separate crowd to, or a separate audience to what you're doing, other than just scuba divers. Would it be fair to say that?
Yeah. So I'll run you through pretty much how I approached what I thought to be kind of a few missing links in the whole conservation world, right? So from my perspective, mm-hmm. Conservation is in part mainly awareness driving. and action steps. So if you can have an awareness driver that literally goes into an immediate action step, that to me is conservation, because you're addressing the issue, you're shining a light on the issue, and then you're actually going and doing something about it, right? So if you're that dive company in Thailand or wherever it may be, and you've got wireframes on the floor, sea floor, well, that's not really inspiring to tourists. And then you can't really monetize that. You can, and people are doing it. They're going, hey, come on an eco dive. You can see the nurseries and the coral, and it's all good. Come plant a coral, adopt a coral, and all the rest of it. And it works fine. It's great, right? I mean, but it's not for me as a diver, an artist, a photographer, a videographer. That is not inspiring. So I wanted to tick that box. So when you do have a snorkeler or you have a diver and they're diving on this, you know, conservation effort that's being undertaken, I want it to be inspiring. I want it to be something that you would swim down with your GoPro, take a shot of it, share it on social media, and guess what? You've done my work for me, because I don't have to go and do that awareness driver as much anymore. I don't have to bang on doors and go, look what we're doing. We're doing coral reef restoration. Look how cool it is. Well, somebody else is doing that worldwide for us now, and we have hundreds of people doing that on a daily basis, sharing it on their social medias all the time. We're seeing, I'm getting tagged in our on our Instagrams and stuff like that, that they've visited this place, they've taken a picture, and they're now sharing it with their network. So we've ticked that awareness driver by proxy by building these cool underwater sculptures, right? And then when we do those sculptures and we plant them with coral, we're using those sculptures as a coral gene bank. And this is something that is slightly unusual too, because a lot of coral conservation efforts are, we go get, say, corals of opportunity. And for those who don't know that, that could be coral that has been snapped off in a cyclone and it's tumbling around on the sand and you leave it there for too long, it's going to die. Or it could be an anchor that's been dropped or a line that's been towed over a reef and it's just snapped a bunch of stuff. And more often than not, it's tourism. So tourists would be standing on the reef, and we were just in Fiji going, I can't believe people are still doing this in this day and age, literally standing on reef, and we're diving behind them, collecting the broken coral. That's how bad it's getting these days. So we'll then take, just for argument's sake, these corals of opportunity, and we'll put them on the sculpture. But in addition to that, we're going after rare coral species. So we were just in Fiji diving, say, a 10 to 15 mile square area, and we found one coral that demonstrated a uniqueness that around all the other corals that were there, that species didn't exist anywhere else. So for us, that's a viable coral species that we want to propagate. So we'll actually go and take a piece. So that's not a coral of opportunity. That's actually us harvesting from that coral because it's demonstrating that genetic rarity. And then we'll put that on our sculptures. And then we also go after what's called hotspot coral, which is corals that have demonstrated a resilience to climate change and the ocean temperatures rising, which is one of the main causes of coral dying, is the ocean temperatures are rising. And we can go through all that later, but sticking to the sculptures, we go after the hotspot coral that have demonstrated those resilience. And we can literally see it in real time. So we have, say, a patch of staghorn coral. One section is completely dead, the other section is half dead, and the other section is thriving as if nothing's going on. So we go after that thriving coral and the coral that's half dead, and we put that onto the sculptures because it's already demonstrating a genetic superiority over its own family member that may not have that strong relationship with the algae that resides within coral, because they have a symbiotic relationship with this algae called Zooxanthella. So we go after those and we plant those onto the sculptures. Now we have a sculptural coral gene bank, which is now being housing these rare corals, corals of opportunity and resilient corals. We allow them to grow out, and this is the kind of cool part about it. We allow those to grow out to spawning maturity. So we allow them to go through spawning cycles. We allow them to grow big enough, ready to harvest. And we call those the mother plant or the parent plant. And we'll take then small fragments off of those sculptural corals, because now we have a controlled environment. We're no longer having to go out into the reef, find corals of opportunity and put them onto nurseries, grow them out and plant them back out into the reef. We now have a conveyor belt of coral being grown in one spot, that we harvest, plant onto secondary nurseries, allow those secondary fragments to grow out to maybe 2 years, 3 years, then those corals go back onto the reef and the parent plant continues the cycle of producing that rare genetic species, that coral's opportunity, and that climate resilient coral. So it's doing the job for us. And that's where we kind of differ from a lot of the other conservation organizations.
Yeah, I think the big element that you've got there is that you're using your areas of growth away from the reef and then reintroducing those corals back to its origins. That's a large element that a lot of locations wouldn't be doing. It would just be staying and remaining on the framework that they've initially put in.
Yeah, it's a lot more work what we're doing, but for me that work is valuable because I want a reefscape to be natural. I don't want wireframes on a reefscape. That's not what I'm in this game for. I'm there to rebuild those reefs so they look organic and natural again. Even though we'll have to take those corals that have grown out over a 2 year period and then plant them onto the reefscape, we plant them in a very unique way and we've developed our own technologies for that, which we'll probably share next year once we've implemented it. Kind of similar to a lot of other people, but we're trying to do a different approach. But then part of the other like elements to what we do, so we do what we call a closed loop system. So we have the conservation, we have the awareness driver, and we have the gene bank, right? So conservation and the gene bank are kind of the same thing. We have the awareness driver that we're demonstrating the artwork through building it, showing people on TikTok, shipping it, you know, droning the boats coming up with the parts. We sink it into the ocean. We're filming all this stuff. We're showing off this art piece. We're planting coral on it. But then we have a marketing opportunity for our partners. So we tend to want to put our sculptures near resorts. So you can have now stakeholders in the environment. When you create a stakeholder in an environment, they tend to protect it a little bit more than they did before. So now they have a marketing opportunity for their resort to say, hey, come and dive on Counting Coral sculptural art piece. It's a conservation effort, but there's a cool point of interest on your trip that you may want to enjoy. Come stay with us. Now they're vested. They're involved now. So they get to tell our story by proxy because we go back every year. Hey, guess what? We just planted 400 corals. They get to say, hey, we've been part of this planting process. We've partnered with Counting Coral. We've grown this out. We've helped them, you know, whatever the partnership details are, kind of plays out for many years. So they got this constant story and we're going to give them content so they can constantly update their websites, their marketing team. So they now have fresh content every year to demonstrate their commitment to the environment. So stakeholders are incredibly important when it comes to protecting anything anywhere on our planet. If people don't care, they don't care. They'll chop down trees, they'll kill rhinoceroses, and they'll just tear up reef with dynamite fishing, cyanide fishing. They don't care, right? But you bring in new revenue streams for local organizations, local communities, because communities can now do snorkeling trips and market themselves to be able to bring more revenues in. And then we have the last part of that closed loop system is working with the local communities. It is so valuable to understand that when you involve the local communities, you always win. You'll never lose that battle because you're supporting them. So what we do in that respect is we've asked the resort that we're currently working with to say, hey, part of these revenue streams that you're making money from need to go back to the village. So we have a donation program set up that revenues are going to go back to the chiefs. Now, the chiefs in Fiji own the reef rights. They've given us permission to allow to do that. So it's only just that we give back. But in addition to that, every time we go back to Fiji, we have after school clubs because we've asked the school district if we can educate the youngsters. We're talking kids from, say, 10 to 15 years old. So we do an hour every day to go in, teach them about coral, teach them about environment, teach them about fishing practices, teach them about our work. And then now we're really invested. Now the community is invested because those young people are now being educated. And you'd be surprised that in Fiji, they're next to the ocean. They're dealing with reefs every day, and they're stepping on it, breaking it, ripping it up. They don't see the value. They don't understand the connectivity with coral, fish, environment, humanitarian types. It's all connected, right? So we educate them. So that, and then that's the closed loop system, where we've ticked all the boxes we could possibly tick in one installation. And then we do that over the course of, say, 10 years, and we get to rebuild a reef, or many reefs, over 10 years. So it's a long, long process, and very complicated to even pull that off.
It's got, you've got to be kind of excited. I know it's probably exciting and very frustrating getting everything done all the time, but 5, 6, 7 years down the line, when your installations are, you know, effectively in full bloom, and these people that are looking at ways to support conservation, to show that they're in the Green Party or whatever, they're going to be kicking themselves for not getting on board in the early days, because they're going to have to wait again for, you know, to sing the praises 5, 6, 7 years later down the line, when they've got a new reef of their own out the front.
Yeah. You know, I want the clock to move forward, but also it's slightly terrifying, because the future for coral reefs is pretty dismal. But, you know, we're just trying to put our best foot forward in a very small ecosystem that we think we could help. And, you know, it's also the outplanting process has to be very specific. So you can't plant coral in 3 feet of water anymore and expect in 5 years it's going to survive, because it's toast. There's a lot of reefs that we visited in Fiji that are just absolutely dead, gone. While we were there, resorts and their managers were coming over to us asking if we could help, because no one's up there doing this work, right? So you have countless reef systems that are just in complete collapse, and it's sad to see, because we literally have to tell them there's no hope, and we're not even going to put our time into it. We're really, really sorry, but we cannot help you. This is too far gone, too down the road. We're going to have to focus on coral reefs that are, say, 70% in decline, because at least there's hope that we could bring it to maybe 50% of its coverage. Because right now, most reefs are about 30% coral coverage, maybe 50 if you're lucky, up in that region. Mm. We were hoping to push it to 70, maybe 80% coral coverage in the next 10 years. And these are large systems, you know. This is not like a small area. We're doing 8 different reefs. We have a very interesting way of approaching what we do too. So each one of our sculptures has its own. We do different, very, very different sculptures on different areas, but this one particular had 8 limbs to it, much like a starfish. It was a centerpiece, and eight legs, you could use them, say. And each leg houses a specific reef of coral. So we go to that reef, we harvest that, we put it onto that leg, we label it, we know that leg is this reef. So when we go into the production line of all that coral, it all goes back to that original reef. So we have 8 reefs in total that we'll be restoring over the next 10 to 15, 20 years. So we know that coral gene is going back to its home origins. And then we plant it at, say, 10 feet to 15 feet. So we know it's at least got a hope. So there'll be a little band of coral at that elevation. And we'll see how it goes over 10 years with the ocean temperatures rising. And if we need to shift them down a little lower into cooler waters, then, you know, we've got that genetic stock still being produced that we can do that with.
And how do you, have you got some sort of like science geeks that are assisting you? Because I can imagine that over a period of time, that is there a possibility of stronger corals within your installation being able to dominate the weaker corals and effectively obliterate them?
Yeah, so we work with marine scientists all over the world. We got 3 marine biologists in our team. We have our director of science. We got we're basically covered in that respect, and we're not short of marine biologists, because, you know, you come out of school and you want to be a marine biologist, and yet you've got no hours under your belt. You got to prove yourself. So there's a lot of people running around going, and we get tapped up all the time. Can we come help? Can we volunteer our time? Blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it's wonderful. We appreciate people reaching out to us. But, you know, it's not something we take lightly. So we want experienced people. Unfortunately, we've built a pretty good team of experienced people. And they're teaching me. I'm a construction guy. I've got a passion for the ocean. I'm a citizen scientist. It's all pretty common sense shit when you actually put your mind to it, but it takes a lot of putting your mind to getting behind all this stuff, right? So then I'm sitting there being educated by one of our guys. He's like, this is a such and such and such and such coral. I'm like, excuse me, could you repeat that again? Because that is a foreign language you're talking to me. I understand, like, staghorn, you know, plate coral, all of that. When you go into those scientific names, you lose me. But, you know, I'm capable of doing what we need to do to build a really comprehensive team that knows what they're doing and don't mess up. But listen, everybody's going to mess up in this game, right? This is all new territory for so many people. I mean, they're only just understanding that that relationship that coral has with the Zoan Zamfella is the key to coral survival. So now they're looking at the genetics of this algae, that how do they propagate that algae that's now heat resistant or climate resistant. So it's not so much about the coral anymore, it's now about this host plant essentially that's living in this animal that they need to focus on to see how we can get those strains of algae to remain in the coral during a heat event, you know. So It's complicated and it's a moving target, but from my perspective, it's too late to be messing about. You've got to put your hands in and get dirty and go for it. And if you make mistakes, then so be it. You correct those mistakes and you keep moving forward. Otherwise, you just wouldn't make the decision to do anything. You just spin your heels.
That's right. Yeah. I'm a big advocate of fucking up. You know, if you mess up and you make errors, then you learn from it. And that's the only way you're going to learn. You know, if you stay safe and within your theory box, then nothing's going to get done, really, is it? Nothing changes.
100%. I'm in the construction industry. If I sat around and questioned how to do certain things, I'd be without a job. People say to me, "Can you do this?" I say yes, and I don't know how to do it, but I figure it out and I pull it off. But I make those mistakes that I learn for the future, and it will cost me. I do jobs for free sometimes. Because I didn't do it in the time frame, I didn't do it on budget, and I'll suck that up because the value is the learning experience, in my opinion. So if I don't make money on a certain job, but I've learned that value, and that value proposition translates to another job because now someone's referring me, I've won. You know what I mean? So that's my perspective, is never stop, keep moving forward. Otherwise, you're just... Procrastination is death sentence to, like, the productive people, you know?
Yeah. Hey, you should get your marine biologist having a quick tete-a-tete with Jen Matthews at UTS. She was on the show not so long back, and we used to
work
together
that.
In Thailand. She makes me look, I make myself look stupid, but she makes me look really stupid.
I listened to your podcast. That was great.
she's something else, but all of the stuff that we're trying to protect with coral and what they're doing there at the university is just simply fantastic. And it's only a hop across the water to Fiji, really. You know, it's all very close. And I used to work up in Papua New Guinea and, you know, see the GBR last week on the outer reefs. And the reef structures and species are so similar. You know, you could lift them and put them in PNG and you wouldn't know the difference.
Well, it's one of those cool things. So we're going after this coral, right? So one of our marine biologists, we pull up a piece of coral that had been pretty much half killed by a crown of thorns. And, you know, it's this beautiful, massive coral. And half of it was just laid on the ground bleaching, you know, but it was in that death cycle, essentially, because it had been half eaten. Lots of it fell over. We brought it up and we're looking at it, and it's got all this polyp structure on it that he'd never seen before. So we sent it off to one of our marine scientist friends, took a picture of it, and they said, hey, you better think of a name, you may have found another subspecies of coral that has not been documented in Fiji. And we're like, you're joking, right? And he's like, no, he said, because nothing's been documented in Fiji. They just say whatever's in Australia is in Fiji, but that's not the case. And we're hoping we found a new subspecies and we get to name it. So unfortunately, Fiji doesn't let us send the DNA out of the country just yet. We have to get special permission for it. But it's on our sculptures growing out. So we're like super excited that we may have found something new.
That's
if
awesome.
If you can believe it. Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
What's the Latin name you're going to put to it? Like Jolianus Coriolanus?
Yeah, that's it. Counting Carlos. Oh,
yes. So where you've got the structure at the moment, is it just the one structure, the one location that you're focusing on?
No, we're in negotiations. So I'm going to preface it, all this stuff, with saying this. I can scale a marine park to hundreds and hundreds of sculptures. I can design whatever I want. I can ship them anywhere in the world. I can weld up thousands of parts. I can install it into the ocean. But guess what the hardest part is? Making the partnerships and making the deals. We spend years doing this. I mean, it's a shoot me now moment, right? Hey, we're going to donate a $60,000 sculpture to you, create this incredible conservation effort, do all the work for you for free, plant thousands of corals. Do you want in? And then they're procrastinating. We don't make the deal. Certain issues come up. They're like, is this a financial viable option for our resort? Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, are you kidding me? You're saying no to this? So we spend years trying to get locations, trying to make these deals, get permissions. So Fiji happens to be one of those playgrounds that I've played in for so many years. So I know a lot of the managers, resort owners. I know the chiefs personally for many, many years because I've worked with them. I've got community members up there that still know me from 20 years ago, that still recognize me because I've been up there so many years. And we hang out and we have this connection. So we're in negotiations for another resort. We're going to do an installation hopefully in March. And while we're doing that installation, we're going to build out the secondary nursery tables for the first installation. And then we have another opportunity down in the Mamanuka Islands. So we're hoping to do 6 installations in Fiji in the next 2 years. That's our general plan. But as I said, negotiations can fall off really quickly. And that's the most complicated, difficult part about it. And you would be surprised that you have a hard time giving this away.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't you, see or hear on one of your other podcasts this issue that you're talking about with partnerships, particularly focusing on Hawaii?
Yeah, we started in Hawaii, but it turns out that you got to lease the sea floor, So you got to go to the Division of Aquatic Marine Resources. I think they call it DAR as an acronym. And I spent 5 months. Then we had to hire, get the Army Corps of Engineers to go over our designs. We had to lease the ocean floor. It takes 2 years to get a permit to even plant coral on it once you put the sculptures in. And you're losing, I think they lost another 5% of their reefs in the last few years. So it's like, okay, you carry on doing that. See how it works out for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've got a friend who works for Coral Conservancy out there. He's one of our team members and board members. He has his own non-profit. It's taken him a year just to plant corals of opportunities back on the reef. So that's literally a fragment that's fallen off. He just goes, picks it up and sticks it back on the reef. It took him a year to get that permit. And he's only allowed to work in specific areas. So, yeah, you watch your reefs go, guys, and no one's going to be there to bail you out when you need the help. So I gave up.
Well, that's it. Well, I mean, once it's gone, isn't it? You can't throw a load of money at it and chuck a load of coral in and hope it's going to grow.
Well, look, I always say this to people, right? So I say, people don't understand what's actually going on, right? So coral reefs occupy at least 1 to possibly 2% of equatorial oceanscapes, right? So that's within, say, a 50-foot range, just to get a blanket statement, right? So you got Thailand, Indo, all these places, really shallow reefs occupying a very small percentage. They supply 25% of the population with food directly, indirectly, coastal protections. I mean, the list goes on of what coral reefs are benefits from. Not to least, the very last thing is the medications that are coming from reefs. They're supporting heart disease issues, Alzheimer's issues, cancer research. There's a lot coming out of these reefs, right? And there's just, for argument's sake, let's say the Great Barrier Reef. I think they've lost about 50% of their reefs. Certain parts are losing upwards of 90%. You can say isolated reefs, yes, great. Certain areas are doing really well. Now, you go to a tree organization that's planting trees, right? I think Ethiopia beat the world record for 360 million trees planted in one day. That was over India that planted 300 million trees in a day. You try and do that on a coral reef system where you got to have at least a minimum advanced rescue diving, in my opinion, to dive safely. That's going to take you God knows how much money, plus all your equipment. And then you got an hour of air to go plant coral, and you got to plant, you know, 1,600 miles of it, a mile wide. Are you kidding me? You think this is an easy thing you're doing? You're out of your mind. Me and you could go to the local, you know, nursery, pick up a bunch of trees and a shovel and a bucket of water and plant at least 100 trees, just you and I. Easily in a few days, right? That's easy conservation. You can sequester carbon using trees or rebuilding habitats. You try and do that in the ocean, mate, no way. Not going to happen. So what we're looking at is gene banks, small gene banks that we can just keep a very small stock of genetic superior coral in the hopes that we can continually plant that out. Because as it dies, we can only protect in our organization a very small percentage. And in the hopes that that can act as a gene bank for the future. So, I mean, that's a loosely kind of bracketed comment as well, you know.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate, but it's you know, it's how we live nowadays. Everything needs funds to be able to be achievable. It's a difficult scenario. What's the long range, you know, rose tinted kind of view? Where do you want to see this in, say, 20 years?
Well, so much like the gene bank comment, so just imagine, and this is the big picture, right? For me, at least. We can do collectively a lot of small gene banks. But those gene banks have the ability to produce thousands and thousands of corals. Now imagine that gene bank, and we're talking like, I don't know, just, you know, use your imagination. Every time I dream big, stuff happens, right? I'm at the top of my game in the building industry in Malibu. I've created a non-profit in 2 years. We've got our first installation in. We're planting thousands of pieces of coral using a completely different technique. Thinking different, dreaming big, right? So imagine I go to the government of Fiji and say, hey, you've got some waters that are owned by the government. You give us those waters and we create a national park. Now, that national park is managed by rangers. So you imagine, like, say, the Grand Canyon, right? You go to the Grand Canyon and there's a state park guy there and it charges you $25 to go in to see the Grand Canyon, right? So it's called a concession. And those concessions are owned by private entities. So you go into that park and there's a restaurant. Well, that concession has been bidded on by somebody to be able to run that restaurant. And the state gives the permission to do that because they don't want to run a restaurant, but they need food in the park for people. So it's very much the same thing in the ocean. We become the concessionaires for that national park. The government pays for it, but we put down, say, 7 acres of the largest gene bank in the world for Fiji's reefs. We have hundreds and hundreds of sculptures. It becomes a very large point of interest for divers all over the world to come and dive on Cow and Coral Sculpture and Marine Park because it is so intricately designed and amazing, and it's only a small fee to come into the national park. But we get to manage that underneath the national park fees. So essentially, the fee to go into the national park sustains non-profit, us as a non-profit. So now we're not scrounging for donations. And honestly, the amount of time we put into getting donations will shock you. And the amount of effort we have to put into it, you just say, give up now. It's ridiculous. We're scraping at the bottom barrel. It's not like people are just chucking millions of dollars our way, right? And going, hey, guys, do your best, which we would do if we had that money. But we just don't have that revenue. So, OK, we could be a self-sustaining nonprofit if we run a national park because the concession will pay us to do it. So then we have this self-managed ecosystem where we're creating this gene bank, we're supplying the entire nation with coral, and we're being paid to do it, but we pay the government off as a percentage, so they're getting a kickback on the entry to the park fee anyway. We're getting a little bit to be self-sustainable, and we're doing our job the way we should do it without being hindered by fundraising every single day. So that's the big picture. You know, national parks, marine protected areas, they're needed and they're extremely valuable. And then the big picture for Fiji for us is we've already negotiated this deal with the chief up in the Asawas. So it's very complicated chief and family system in Fiji. You have chiefs, Metangalis, clans, all of this type of stuff. Well, the one guy up in Fiji, he's the high chief of half of the island chain. He controls four chiefs. his say kind of goes against everybody else's say, but they've all got to kind of agree to do something, and then it happens. So give you an example. The High Chief can say, I want this to be a marine protected area, and anybody in his world will not fish there. They call it a tambu. We're not allowed to fish there, not allowed to be there. But the other chiefs can come in and fish there because they weren't part of that whole big picture deal, right? So when we did our installation, we managed to get all seven chiefs of the entire island chain, which they haven't spoken in 27 years, to actually sit down, all seven of them, because they're split between the northern chain of the Asawas and the southern chain. Got them all together to agree to create this marine protected area where our park's going. Now no one can fish there. Now we've got a marine protected area. But in condition to that, I said, Chief, listen, do us a favor. Let us map the islands and we'll give you a top recommendations of areas that you can create tambus. So in my opinion, I could create a big marine protected area, but that does nothing for the community. What I want to do is do small isolated pockets where we know we can supply those pockets with coral. We know marine biomass will increase because no one's fishing in that area. That biomass will then swim out into the what we call shipping, what I call fishing lanes. So you have, say, 100 marine protected areas. The Fijians are really good with understanding their environment. So we say you're allowed to ship within these areas and fish between these areas. So then the biomass is spilling out in all these different areas and fish are going into those fishing lanes. And if everybody sticks to those rules, there'd be more fish than you can handle, because the production of a reef, once it gets real healthy, is pretty astonishing. I mean, it can go up with upwards of 400% in biomass in a very small period of time, less than 10 years. So he agreed to allow us to map. So while we were there, we mapped one island. When we go back, we're going to map another island, and we're going to put a suggestion for him to say, hey, let's get all the chiefs together again, create these marine protected areas / tambus, and just be in agreements that these are non-touchable areas forever, and let the fish start living and, you know, spilling out into these waterways. So that's something we're doing right now in the marine, in the big park. Is, you know, down the line, hopefully, if I can get to talk to somebody of any importance at Fiji, but it takes time. You know, those chiefs will start talking. We were lucky enough to have the Ministry of Fisheries come up and officiate the marine protected area with us. We had a huge ceremony up there. It was awesome. So we do have that connection in Fiji to maybe talk about a national park in the next 10 years. We'll see how it goes.
With those mapping the locations and giving the advice to the chiefs, and I'm just thinking to, and I forgive me if I get it wrong, it's either Philippines or Indonesia, they do a similar kind of thing where they'll close off a section of the reef for a 3 to 5 year period and no one's allowed to fish whatsoever, and then rotate it through. I'm just thinking, well, have you considered that kind of thing for down in Fiji? Because I can imagine some of the villagers might be, well, if I can't fish just off the shore of where I live, why can they fish just off the shore where they live, and I've got to travel down there? Do you have any of those kind of issues that have been raised?
They've been doing that for 1,000 years in Fiji. That's a very common practice. And I think through Indonesia and all that is a very, it's like crop rotation right on land. You know, once you implement crop rotation, you end up with healthy plants and strong vitamin content in your lettuce, and you're eating healthy food, right? So they've understood this for a very long time. But the problem is, so just for argument's sake, the Yasawas didn't have a single resort on it. And then the last 20 years is now 40 resorts. So you've got all these guys fishing for the resorts, and then you've got the resorts fishing for the resorts themselves, because this is kind of the big scam with resorts, or not scam, but it's kind of a scam in my sense. They go, hey, we're off for sports fishing. You come on the boat, $500 a day. We go catch a fish. You don't actually keep the fish. You take a cut of the fish, and that fish goes in our freezer. So you've just packed our freezer for $500 a day, and you get a small cut at dinner or a couple of days worth of fish, and thank you very much. So it's like the resorts are going out, you know, hooking massive fish, stocking the freezers, and people are paying to do that for them. So in my opinion, it's a bit of a scam, but yeah, it is what it is, business, right? In my opinion, if we can protect these areas and not crop rotate, but keep them as consistent production areas, then they'll just non-stop produce. They're not going to go into a decline because now you've opened up the fishing rights to it, and then they go and smash it because there's a load of fish in there, and it's like, oh, sweet. this huge production, you're better off allowing that stuff to spill out into the fishing highways and maintain it for forever. And you know, be mindful of where these guys are fishing and saying, okay, well, we won't want to protect that because you are fishing here, these are productive grounds, but a mile up the way there we could protect that. You stick to your fishing grounds, and a mile away where you don't go particularly, we'll get that reef healthy for you and start biomass production of fish through its natural cycle.
Yeah, yeah. Just don't tell the Chinese fishing fleet where you're doing it.
Yeah, there's some big boats in Fiji right now. Yeah, there's some big boats in Fiji right now.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Huge vessels coming in. This... Not good. It's not good at all. But we're talking local stuff. Yeah.
That's a. I mean, the fishing vessels, the industrial fishing vessels, clearly aren't local on what we're talking about. But it's something that everyone seems to avoid talking about. You know, the fact that the impact that these things are having, and you know, just decimating what is in the oceans. It just, it's making life extremely difficult for the likes of the Fijians that are living off the land and the sea, and the same for the Papua New Guineans that are, you know, they don't have KFC down the road, a McDonald's or a supermarket. You know, you've got to go into the jungle or into the ocean and get what you can to survive. I don't know how, excuse me, I don't know how it gets regulated or, you know, with companies or individuals coming in with millions of dollars and saying, hey, give us your fish, this is what you'll get, and it's, you know, it's the top 1% that are making these decisions and everyone else is suffering.
Yeah, there's backhanders going on in every country across the world to allow these fishing boats to come in and just rape the oceans, and it's a very, very destructive practice, and I'm not a big fan of it, and I'll advocate till the day I die not to do that ever again. In my opinion, there should be a worldwide ban on all fishing for 15 years. At least give the ocean a slight chance. You know, small vessels, radio tracked, that can go out into local seas and only catch a very small percentage of fish. And just let the oceans get back to normal. If that takes 20 years, then so be it. I don't really care about any of the other stuff. I've got no interest in it. I don't care how much money you lose. The money you're gaining now is not going to help anybody in the future for those small gains of money that, you know, a few individuals are making. Because it's not the fishermen particularly that are making it. You know, you got, you know, pirates in Thailand that are kidnapping people and having, you know, basically kidnap people on the boats working for free, and then they're offloading those fish for peanuts, and then once it goes up to the chain, the big boys are making massive money. In my opinion, it should all be shut down now, today, if I had my choice.
I'd be
a tyrannical leader if I had my way. No one would like me, but I'd do it all for the good, greater good of humanity. You know what I mean? I'd be a dictator. People wouldn't like me very much.
That's a good dictatorship, though. I mean, just giving other species a chance to catch up. Bloody hell.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you imagine that? Can you imagine how much of a better world it would be if we just completely stopped eating and fishing fish?
Yeah, I haven't eaten fish for years, mate. I mean, I stopped eating fish when I went into the oceans off of here on Point Doom. I went into the marine park and I just saw how beautiful it was. I said, I'm never eating a fish ever again. It's a small lie, because I do eat a little fish when I'm in Fiji, because I'm with the Fijians and they're fishing every single day, and you know, it is kind of like a pride for those guys to share their meals and stuff. So I do indulge in fish, and it's caught locally, it's caught sustainably, and it's kind of considered rude not to participate, and we like to be very connected to the community that we're working with. So I do bend that rule a little bit there, but that's the only ever time I eat fish.
Okay, just a couple of quick fire questions for you.
All right. Go for it.
If you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
That would have to be work less.
Work less. But then working less, would you have the success that you've got now?
Yeah, 100%.
Really?
I was retired like 7 years ago. So okay. I could have pushed my retirement to, say, 4 years ago and worked a little less when I was a youngster. I'm a lunatic, you know, and nothing really stops me. I'm just that action person that just try and take life by the by the horns and go for it. And I've pretty much done everything I've ever imagined I'd want to do. Traveled the world, dove everywhere, surf everywhere, got a family. I'm like complete in that way. And that's why I started the non-profit was, okay, a life without purpose isn't worth living. So my purpose back in those days was to be the best craftsman I could, get to retirement, do what I did. I've done that. So now I'm going to give back to the planet, give back to my family. My kids work in the non-profit, so they're educating themselves on all of this stuff. They're diving the world. They're having a great experience. That to me is a big win and a big tick on that box. So I'm just going into conservation, and like I say, a life with purpose is now feeling pretty good. I am working in Malibu right now on a few projects because I needed to position myself here for the non-profit, and we're looking to raise a couple $100,000 because I'm here, because I'm around the wealthy people and engaging with a lot of people that are into the ocean. So that's why I'm kind of living in Malibu out of retirement for the next few years. And then once I'm done with this project, we'll have enough money for maybe 10 years worth of parks. So I'm hoping.
Happy days. So you can get a bit of aggressive fundraising done with the rich people and get that dollar in and get the good stuff done.
Yeah, that's 100%. I'm around it. There's surfers here. There's a lot of people that go to Fiji, Hawaii surfers. You know, there's a lot of guys here that, you know, I can leverage my relationships in the construction business. So I'm kind of like a bit of a mafia dude. So it's like, dude, you want this contract? You donate to my cause. You don't donate, you don't get the contract. So everyone's like, yeah, of course we can give you money. We love you. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, thanks. I didn't want to break your kneecaps. So I'm leveraging those relationships too, but in a good way, you know what I mean? People are really respectful and love what we're doing, so they're happy to help.
I think that's the admirable thing. You've come from an industry which is, you know, it's not focused on conservation. Let's be fair, it's not focused on conservation at all. It's all about making money, making buildings, moving on to the next one and making more money, whether it's for yourself, your own business, or for the businesses that you're, you know, contracted to, or individuals. And being able to take that success and those links that you've got and now open the eyes to those individuals and say, hey, we're doing all this shit, but what we're doing is missing out on all this goodness over here. So bringing those two together and moving monies from one element into a better environment, I think I've got to applaud you for that.
Yeah, so this is the way I look at it, right? So I was chopping a piece of wood in my 20s going, what am I doing, man? This is ridiculous. I hate this. I feel sick to my stomach. I'm chopping trees down. I'm a part of it, right? We're pouring concrete all the time. So then that flicked the switch of conservation. It was the same time I kind of got into diving, and I was a really young person, right? So now every job that I do, I source sustainable materials as much as I can. I flat out don't work with hardwoods anymore. We were working with Honduras mahogany maybe 20 years ago, and I went to my supplier and I said, hey, you know, I want to get a few board feet. We're building this beautiful, I don't know, whatever the hell it was for some rich person. And they're like, we don't have it. I'm like, oh, when are you going to get it? And they said, we're not going to get it anymore. They've stopped shipping it from Honduras because there's no more left. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? What do you mean there's no trees left? They're like, yeah, they don't ship it anymore. So you can't get Honduras mahogany in the US anymore. So it was like, that was a big awakening call to me. So now, you know, people are saying, oh, I want an Ipe deck, which is a Brazilian hardwood. I'm like, go get somebody else to do it, dude. I'm not touching that with a 10-foot barge pole. In fact, I'm going to tax you if you ever use that on my job or want to push me on that. I'll tax you heavily and then you donate as a carbon offset. So, you know, I'm leveraging all those relationships. And I point out to people that everything in this industry is an extraction from natural resources from our planet. So imagine this for an instance, right? That the sand that I use for my concrete has had a tax on it from every single stage, from the guy digging it out of the pit. He pays a small tax, like we're talking tiny tax, 0.1% tax for conservation. Then it goes to the guy that bags the sand. He pays a tax. Then it goes to the guy at the local hardware store. They pay a tax. Then the builder pays a tax when he buys it to do it on his construction guy. I pay a tax. The homeowner pays a tax. Everybody starts paying a tax on all these resources. Conservation wouldn't be an issue. Everybody would be doing the right thing right now, because there'd be enough money funneled into conservation through these simple taxes, conservation tax on everybody, because everybody's a part to play in it. It's not the guy that's selling the bag of sand. It's the guy that dug it up and the guy that's using it and the guy that's living in the house that's benefiting from it. So in my opinion, all these resources need to be taxed, because every single thing in your home, just look around for a second, look at the microphone, the headphones, the t-shirts, the glass, it's all an extraction of a natural resource and they're running out. So, hey, put back in, man. Don't take, don't steal. I wouldn't be putting up with it if someone came into my house and stole something. I'd be giving them a dig and saying, what are you doing coming in my house and stealing? Well, we're doing that with Mother Nature on a daily basis. So enough's enough, and it's got to stop. We got to step up, yeah. Man. We're all a part of it. I mean, you cannot morally say in any good conscience you have nothing to do with it. So everybody's got something to do with it.
But then how would you, I mean, if you got that example there, that ideal example of getting of taxing everyone along the stream, how do you regulate the person that's controlling all of that tax coming in? You know,
well, hopefully you would rely on an honor. Yeah, hopefully you would rely on an honest government. So if you look at
yeah,
that's the crux of the whole plan, right?
yeah. As soon as politics gets involved and politicians are involved in particular, it goes tits up.
Yeah, I understand that, but somewhere you can't use all those as excuses not to try. You've got to try something, right? So you look at the tax system in the US, for instance. You know, there's a certain amount of taxes that are allocated to ocean conservation. I think it's 0.01% goes to conservation, which is, I mean, it's the largest ecosystem on our planet, and 0.01% of the tax cuts go to ocean, or grants go to the ocean. So that could be increased by 30%. Now, yes, there's room for corruption, but we're talking 0.01% up to 20 or 30%. There'd be huge gains in the environment to be able to be made when you've got that type of resources at your fingertips.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
Give it to me. I'll go do good stuff with it. No one gets paid in our organization. We're all doing it for free. So it's all just philanthropic. That's why I started a non-profit. Could have been for profit. I could have made money doing this. But as soon as money gets involved, I've been in business long enough to know that I can have a business partner friend for years. All of a sudden, that goes real south when money's involved. So I've never really wanted money ever involved in a non-profit. I always want to keep it super clean. And I know that everybody who's interested in what we're doing is doing it for the love of the coral, love of the ocean, and love of just the whole process. And money is a byproduct of what we need to do our work. End of story.
Yeah, yeah. It's unfortunate that it is that enabler that you need, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think we've kind of covered this one, but you can emphasize on it. How does your connection with the ocean enrich your life?
Okay, so for me, experiential knowledge is the key to living. Okay, so a life with purpose, what I was saying, is, you know, not really worth living. Well, in the same token, experiential knowledge for me is what I want to be thinking on my deathbed. I'm not going to be thinking about the car that I owned, or the watch I had on my wrist that just cost $50,000, or, you know, the Lambo that I got in the garage. Yeah, that none of that interests me. When I'm on my deathbed, I'm going to be thinking of my family, the experiences that I've had. So when you look at accumulating experiential knowledge, guess what? I'm going to be a richer human being, because I have the experience of climbing that mountain, hiking in those jungles, swimming in those oceans, surfing those waves. Those are the things that I dream about all the time. I have zero interest in these material objects. They bring me no joy. It's temporary. But when I look back and of my memories, I don't need that content of me filming those surfers 20 years ago. It is as clear in my mind as the day I was shooting it. None of that escapes me. You know what I mean? So accumulation of experiential knowledge. End of story.
Lovely stuff. Right up there with you. I don't give a shit. You can see there's no jewelry, no watches, no nothing. It's all about the doing and seeing.
Yeah, it's a state of mind, right? So just a quick, like, you know, like, add on to that. So we've been retired for 7 years. I have a beautiful home. Me and my wife are living in a construction trailer for two years so I can work my non-profit Malibu. She's like, I hate this goddamn trailer. We're talking, it's on the job site, piles of dirt around us, machinery going all day long. And I said, listen, you know, for me, it's a state of mind. You know, if you're a happy person, nothing externally is ever going to like penetrate you. If you're bothered by external stuff, you're doing something wrong in your life. You know what I mean? You see all these stressed out people in the US, especially in Malibu. They're super rich and they get super stressed out about, I don't know, the waiter not showing up with their warm coffee or whatever. It's like, oh my God, that sent you over the edge and you're living in a $10 million home on the beach. It's like, where's your head at? You know what I mean? So if you can keep your consciousness and your mindfulness and your happiness and your core, you know, core self intact, no matter what's going on around you, you've won in life already, in my opinion.
Yeah. 100%. Okay, let's have another one. How about this one? Now, for anyone who is interested in becoming a conservationist or getting into conservation, what words of wisdom would you impart to them?
Super simple. Stop talking about it, because you've probably told your family members, you've probably been going on about it and saying, oh, you want to do this, you want to do that. Stop talking about it and go and do something. If it's planting trees, then go plant some trees. If it's saving coral, do your dive paddy, reach out to somebody and say, and show up, knock on their doors and just get involved. There's no time wasted if you just put yourself into an action position. Now, a lot of people don't have a lot of time, right? So just pick your times, pick your battles, set your schedules, go do it. Real simple, super simple stuff. It doesn't have to be these grandiose things, right? You know, I started a non-profit. We're doing this huge crap all over the world. It's like, did I need to do that? No, probably not. But that's what keeps me going in life, right? You could just maybe go and support your local guys, like my friend in Hawaii, the Coral Conservancy. Go and do swimming and planting little pieces of coral just with a snorkel. I mean, whatever you want to do, man. It's easy. Just go and do it. That's the whole point.
I've got a good buddy of mine out in Texas, Justin, and he's we met through diving whilst on holiday a number of years ago now, and he got back to Texas and, you know, life's trials and tribulations were pissing him off and getting down, and, you know, he touched base with me and talked about scuba diving. It's like, just find someone to scuba dive in Texas. I mean, fuck me, it's a dry state, but there's water near it, so just get in the water and go. And he created a Texas Scuba Divers, which is a Facebook group, and there's over 7,000 members in there now. And he gets out there once every couple of weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is, and just goes and does a beach cleanup. And the amount of shit that he's pulling out the ocean and out off the beaches, and, you know, sometimes there'll be two or three people with him, sometimes there'll be 10 or 12 people with him, but the stuff that he's doing is just, it's marvellous. And it's super enriching for him. He's a better person for it. He's not that depressive young man that he was 4 or 5 years ago and pissed off with not going diving. He's got something that he's targeting and enjoying. It's fantastic. And and what it's a long-winded way of saying I agree with you. Just get out there and do it. You know, it doesn't matter how big or small it is. Just do it. You know, if it makes you feel happy and it's something good for the world, then do it. Yeah.
I always say stop complaining about it and go do something. You know.
Yeah. Definitely. Is there anything that we might have missed that you want to bring up? Any shout-outs or anything like that?
You know, like I said earlier, it's a relentless fundraising situation. So, I'm going to do those shameless plugs for our organization. We are set on track to probably be around the 200 grand mark by probably next year, hopefully, if all goes well with this construction work we're doing. We do partner with a lot of great organizations. So if anybody's listening and they've got a large business or even a small business, we work with a lot of small businesses, Exhale Coffee, Anarchist Wines, Hair Story, I mean, the list goes on. Think about joining the 1% for the Planet. 1% for the Planet is an organization that bridges businesses to nonprofits. Now, I'm not doing that just for myself. I'm just doing that from a philanthropic standpoint, is to just look at your business model and see if your business model can you know, afford 1%, and that 1% can go to a non-profit that you allocate to. And then you can bridge partners. So what we do is we don't just say, hey, thanks for the donation, we bugger off and get on with our jobs. We like to do infographics and actually build partnerships. So we'll put you on our website, we'll do infographics, shout out on our social medias, we'll do little videos, like Anarchist Wines came to Fiji. One of them turned into a board member. We did a whole photo shoot with their bottles of wine underwater with the coral on the sculptures. Their entire centerpiece of our artwork is their laser engraved logo. And then all the end modules have the large people that donate money. So we got Google, we got Seabob, we've got a bunch of like people that donated. We laser engraved the name on a plaque. So now that laser engraved underwater for the next, you know, few hundred years or wherever long that sculptural park lasts. So we just encourage people to, A, just look at what's going on in the world. And if you have the ability to maybe stretch yourself to 1%, go join that organization or just reach out to us directly. And we'd love to work with you guys and try and do the good work. And we've got a great story. So it's great marketing. If you look at it from a marketing standpoint, you don't get anything better than this. You get free content from us. It's free content. We'll go do the work. We'll give you the content. You put it on your website. You can now shine bright because you're supporting something that's super cool and you didn't spend a marketing dime. All you did is donated, which is a tax-free write-off anyway. And then the other thing is, people, please try and think about this. If you're a larger organization and you've got money, do a personal foundation. So you can have your own foundation, right? That is a personal one that's run by your family. Now you can take up to 30% of your revenues and put that into a foundation as a tax-free write-off. Then you can pay your children to run it, and you only have to allocate 7.5% of that money to a non-profit. So you can be a self-sustaining business entity that you would have given the money to the government, but instead of doing that, you've created a foundation. And you're allocating funds for that foundation and you're paying your kids to run that, or your husband or your wife or whoever it is. You have funds in there, and it's all better than giving it to the government, my opinion. So just think about ways that you can manipulate the system that is legal, completely above board, but you've just never thought about. And that's all I can say, is just try and do your best to step up.
That's a fantastic idea, that foundation idea. Yeah, I need more details on that, I think. And
yeah, and it doesn't have to be a big business, it could be small, you know, a small business operation.
Okay, mate. Yeah. Well, if ever you need, you know, additional hands for mapping and shit like that, I'm only a short flight away to Fiji from Sydney. More than well, more than happy. Yeah,
we'd
more than happy
to
come on
there.
Over and spend some time. Definitely. And all of those links, all of your partners that are helping to invest and make this work and happen, send me the links. I'll put it all in the show notes. Okay.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And for the people that may be interested in the 1%, you can go to our profile and see who we're partnered with and see what we've been up to. And it's a really cool thing, you know. It's not a lot of money,
no,
either, 1%,
no.
If you think about it.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think I will let you get some bed rest, and I'll go and get my morning coffee started. Jolyon, it's been absolutely fantastic talking with you today, and thank you for coming on the show, and keep me abreast of everything that's going on, and let's get an update done in like 12 months or so, see how much progression has occurred.
Yeah, I'd love that, and thanks for having us on, Matt. It's super, super grateful to be able to, you know, connect with you and connect with your audience, because, you know, one of our big objectives is awareness drivers. So the more I get to talk, the more I get to share the stories, the more that information gets out to people, and the more we can open and expand our minds to the realities that are actually coming down upon us, because a lot of people are blindfolded to the situations that are going on, and that could be for many different reasons, you know, bogged down with life, whatever. But these are sometimes what I like to think about as light at the end of the tunnel. If you can start to have a life with purpose and you can see maybe a small bit of hope, and all you got to do is put a few small action steps in line for yourself, you're going to be a joyful and more rounded, full person, because you're moving forward to something positive and with an outcome that can be beneficial to everybody, no matter what that is in life. So I'm so happy that I get to spread this awareness and chat with people and encourage people to do good in the world, you know.
Happy days.
So thank you.
Thanks to you as well. It's been an absolute pleasure, Jolyon. Thank you very much.
This
bye for now, everybody.
Scuba Goat Under the Sea, the podcast for the inquisitive diver.